food, then are tracked, captured for a season, and released, such as the call of paradise.
The voice of Maj Dagama. This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. The program is produced by Forest Woods Media Productions, post-production by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. We wish to thank the Library of Congress for making the program possible. Funding is provided by the Sinipet Fund, the Rivada Foundation, Natalie Canavor, the Anne Arundel Arts Council, and Sandy Jackson Cohen. Mike Turpin's our engineer, and I'm Grace Cavalieri.
Norman Sylvester, the Boogie Cat. You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, Community Radio.
KBOO Community Radio is now on Venmo. Follow us and send a donation anytime at KBOO Radio. That's at KBOO Radio. Thanks.
Good morning, and thanks for listening to Film at 11 here on your community radio, KBOO Portland. As you know, KBOO is a volunteer-powered community platform, which means we are funded by you, the listener. Well, today on a very special Film at 11, we welcome back Lisa Neville of Cortland U in New York State and KBOO's Matthew to discuss the classic of French poetic realism, Court of Shadows, and its importance to its times and its influence on world cinema. Lisa Neville has joined us once again to go into a deep dive in a particular film with Matthew of KBOO's Gremlin Time, the monthly storybook show, here to add his comments. All of us will be talking about Qui de Brume, the Carnet film written by Jacques Prévert and released in 1938 at the height of French cinema craftsmanship, just before World War II comes along and the French film industry is taken over by Germany. What's curious is that Prévert and Carnet stayed there and they struggled against the censorship and ideological overview of the Nazis and made one of the other great masterpieces of cinema, Children of Paradise. Before then, you had Qui de Brume and so many other films, Hotel du Nord, which is often linked with this film because same director, same lead actor. The plot as one in which a army deserter hitchhikes his way to Le Havre, where he is going to hop a ship and go to Venezuela. But while he's waiting, he meets Nelly, played by Michelle Morgan, and they have a fling and spend a lot of time wandering the Le Havre and discussing things and being pestered by this criminal whom the Jean Gabin character humiliates just once too often and leads to dire results. So all of this taking place in a fog-bound coastal city filled with glistening, uneven cobblestones and strange, nearly empty little bayside cafes. In this case, the wonderful, I think it's Café du Panama. In other words, named after a destination, not the place where they are. So everyone's yearning and hoping to get out. Not unlike Casablanca, I guess,
but on a much more minor key.
I thought you were talking about a French New Wave film there for a second. Well, it's a very influential film, though it's not really as great a film as, say, Rules of the Game, which we talked about a year ago or so. This is more straightforward, conventional film. You were saying that you kind of know kind of where it's going to go in a way.
It's an example of the classical cinema, of the well-made movie based on an extremely intricately constructed screenplay. And after the war, the new film writers and critics and eventual filmmakers, including Godard and Truffaut, Claude Chabrol,
Romare,
and many others, they rebelled against what they called the cinema de papa, or daddy's cinema. And they rebelled against the tradition of quality, which they felt inhibited filmmakers from really exploring a sense of reality. Instead of pre-scripted or pro forma, kind of inevitable unhappy endings that aspire to a classical sense of operatic dignity or something like that, they wanted a sense of people, real people on the street, and their avatars briefly became neorealism. And yet there are some neorealistic elements in Port of Shadows, despite its elaborate, misty, noirish cinematography. For example, during the time when they have an affair and they're wandering around the city and talking and getting to know each other, that is very much like some scenes in the early neorealism movies from Visconti, and later on some of the scenes from Antonioni in his trilogy where people are wandering around. But even more important, the scenes in Truffaut and Godard where lovers are having lengthy conversations with each other in bed or in their apartment. I mean, one of the signature moments in any Godard movie is where the lead couple spend about 10 or 15 minutes of screen time in their apartment arguing about philosophy. And that comes from scenes like this in the so-called tradition of quality. It's these passages that seem to not be anchored to a narrative advancement, but to character development, but also philosophical exploration of what their life situation is and what they can do about it.
I think that's a very good point, DK. And I think you're absolutely right that this school of filmmaking, which some people call poetic realism, it does foreshadow both New Wave and Italian neorealism, and of course American film noir.
Oh yeah.
And the Italian neorealism, the thing that I believe it really shares with realistic cinema is the emphasis on working class characters.
Oh yeah.
Right, and the subtle critique of social systems. So the social critique and the working class environment is very, very strong here. And then what do you think about this? Because as I watched it and thought about Truffaut, Godard, etc., I thought that this film, although it's very traditional and it very much follows a narrative continuity cinema,
right,
at the same time, it's very personal and alive. There's a lot of liveliness. And even though the whole film is predictable, at any one given moment when they're speaking to each other, you can be surprised.
I don't think it's all that predictable, except that we've seen 10,000 movies that are like it. But I think to people at the time, the poetic realism element made it seem realistic to them, because that's the way the world worked, you know. It wasn't cleaned up. Everything was dirty. Ports were collections of strange people from around the world, and everything was wet and it was cold, and taverns were run down rooms. So it's poetic realism now because we just find that world really entrancing. But I think that contemporaneous viewers might have found it realistic, unlike the lighthearted romantic comedies and musicals that they were watching, or the Sacha Guitry farces that were extremely popular at the time. So the plot may not have been all that predictable.
It does end on a surprisingly sad note.
And in fact, if I can digress for a second, it was such a shocking ending, and the setting was so decrepit or realistic, you know, run down, that a lot of commentators and newspapers reacted against it, saying, is this what we want to export to foreign countries? This vision of France as this terrible place where criminals run riot and people end up dead in the street and women of the night just wander from one bar to another? No. And as Lisa had mentioned a little bit earlier, Jean Renoir went so far as to call it a fascist film, because it seemed to be endorsing some kind of despairing view, or not despairing,
sort
but
of a nihilistic view.
Nihilistic view, defeatism, mm-hmm. Particularly in the context of 1938, when there was so much tension rising between Europe and Germany, and Germany was so clearly edging for some kind of combat to take back, you know, parts of France and reverse the Versailles. There is a historical context here.
At the time, you know, there's the aftermath of World War One, and the feeling that there's a sort of defeatism in the air, like,
yeah,
we really need to go through this fighting again. Look what we got last time, or look what, there's a bit of that defeatism that's there in the film.
And it's not only defeatism, but Renoir was putting his finger on something, which is also in this movie, which is there was a lot of sympathy with the right wing in France. I mean, you know, the French were not, you know, wildly democratic, and the Nazis were wildly fascistic. I mean, there was a lot of inborn fascist sentiment in France, and it's so that ambiguity, I think, is actually caught in this film.
Well, to quote Colin Crisp in his bibliographical history of French cinema, he said later, Port of Shadows was to be centrally blamed for France's catastrophic defeat in 1940. And banned for the duration of the war.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't just the Germans. Others likened Carnet to a totalitarian agent of the Communist Party, described as a filmmaker. And the screenwriter, Jacques Prévert, he got
into
trouble too.
Yeah. He was a leftist. And I think that that's where we get the poetic element in. You describe the realism very, very well. But the poetic and poetic realism of the great French poetic realist filmmakers has to do with the way that poetry describes reality. And poetry describes reality through allegory, through metaphor, through assonance, through all of these techniques, which allows the poet to articulate something that is essentially inarticulable, to describe an emotional reality that you cannot see and that you cannot describe in words, but that you can somehow allude to and allow the reader to feel. So the poetic realists used all of these techniques to basically show us a reality that is invisible to the eye. And at the same time, they wedded that to the realism of following a narrative and showing us realistic working class environments.
Yes.
And so those two together, in my opinion, I don't know Carnet, but just watching this film, I'm assuming that Carnet really doesn't have much of a political orientation at all. He's trying to describe something, some reality of the human heart.
And true. He's a romantic.
We're in such a political environment, people
yes.
read it.
There's essentially a quartet of characters in this movie, and the narrative follows a succession of encounters among them through the course of the 90 minutes. The other two are Zabel, played by the other great French film actor of the time, Michel Simon, and then the villain of the piece, although I don't know if there's any real villains in the movie per se, but anyway, Lucien, who is played by Pierre Brasseur, who himself was going to go on to become one of the most significant actors in French cinema well into the 60s. Basically, it's a four-character story, and Prévert is intricately trying to set up encounters amongst all of them in twos and threes, and really trying to explore this demi-mondaine, this lower-class world. But there are definite, as Lisa noted, definite class differences between Zabel, for example, and the rather flashy gangster guy, Lucien, played by Pierre Brasseur. And
yeah,
I was wondering if, as you're carried along, they interact really interestingly. For example, Jean, he doesn't put up with Lucien. He's not afraid of him at all. But Zabel is something of a pathetic figure, presented as not much less of a criminal and Lucienne. I just find all these balances very interesting.
And you are listening to Film 11 here on Community Radio KBOO Portland. Please consider becoming a member today.
This morning we're talking about Port of Shadows by Marcel Carnet from 1938. And let's take a little look at what happens in this film. Like any classical cinema, the very first image is important. And here behind the titles, as the film starts, we see the lines of a ship tied to a port. And you can almost see the hull straining at the ropes, just wanting to get off and sail across the ocean. And this is the ship that the hero must find his way to. After the titles, we shift to outside Le Havre, and a truck going through the night meets a soldier along the road who he gives a ride to. And here we meet Jean, played by Jean Gabon. And the truck driver gives him a ride into town. And so we were introduced to him as they're almost like they're sitting in the truck and they don't talk and he's surly, but there is a sort of connection between the two. They share tobacco, and then and so we find out where they're going to Le Havre. He doesn't want to talk about him being a soldier. The driver says, "Are you on a furlough?" And he says nothing, and he doesn't want to talk. So it establishes that he's a man who's like wrapped up in himself. And we learn that he's a man who's trying to run away from something. And so they mostly ride along in silence. And then as they reach Le Havre, a little dog runs out in front of the truck, and Jean reaches over and pulls the wheel and almost crashes the truck. And so there's an argument between him and the truck driver. And John says, the dog deserves to live, but the driver's like, what about me and my rig? And so they get out of the truck, and they were going to go to blows, but now they settle down. But in the course of this, Jean's character talks about kind of why he's left the army and why he's on the run and his disillusionment with shooting and the fighting that went on in Tolkien. And you kind of get the idea that's why he's left the army. And again, it's left up in the air. It's not a movie where we go back and look at a whole bunch of stuff. We just see it right here, and we pick it up with the dialogue. And so at this point, the driver leaves the soldier, and the soldier walks into town, and the dog follows him throughout the whole movie.
The dog is the fifth important character so the dog follows him into town. He gets in the town.
Well, it's important that at that point we cut ahead to this club, and here we meet the villains in this club. And the Zabel, Simon's character, just hates being in this club with the dancing and the modern music, and he's just disgusted. And we find out at this point that there's a missing man, Maurice. The gangsters there are in Maurice's gang or his group, and Maurice is missing. And they think Zabel has something to do with it, because as we find out later, Maurice had been dating up Zabel's ward, Nelly. And we will find out that Maurice has been murdered by Zabel out of jealousy for his attention to the woman. And so once we've kind of get the plot established here, we have a murdered man and somebody's trying to hide it. Jean arrives in town and he meets this sort of beggar character who at first appears to be kind of annoying, and Jean doesn't want to have anything to do with him. But when some military police come down the street, the beggar guy hides him, and John is sort of finding friends at this point. He's got the little dog that's following him. And he has this man who takes him out to the Club Panama, way out on the edge of the pier or someplace. And we meet Panama, and we meet this painter, and we meet Nelly, who's hiding out in the back room. And Jean is very surly, but everyone gives him his space. And so he goes into the back room and he meets Nelly, and they start talking, and she's kind of interested in him because he's got this little dog with him, and she kind of, you know, gets through his sort of surliness. And then as they're talking, the gangsters we met earlier are looking for Zabel or chasing him, and they followed him out there to Panama. And there's some gunfight that breaks out, and shots are exchanged. And after that, Zabel shows up and tries to ingratiate himself into the inn. But when Nelly sees him from the back room, she turns to Jean and tells him, don't let that man know I'm here. And so now we've got this conflict with her. It's very nicely set up with, again, the interplay between the characters, and Zabel is sent on his way, and then it's dawn. And now the place has a whole new look to it. It's bright. It's in the pier. And Nelly herself will say something like, you know, when the sun comes up, I always think something good's going to happen. But then the sun goes down and we go to sleep. And it's sort of like that. But no, this turns out to be a great day, because she and Jean like set off along the pier. And along the way, they meet Lucien and his boys. And Jean just like knocks down the biggest one and slaps around Lucien and sends them on their way. And we have this really nice moment in the film.
Moi aussi, j'aimerais rentrer quelque part. Et si je rentrais, comme tu dis, ce serait...
They're falling in love. That's the main point here. They're falling in love, and they have to separate. And this, of course, foreshadows the whole thing. They have to separate. Wow. She runs to get the streetcar, and the entire street is deserted. There's no people, there's no animals, there's no activity whatsoever. She jumps on the streetcar, and it's a long shot in duration, and it's a deep focus shot. It just follows the streetcar, and the sense of desolation is, in spite of the fact that this should be a joyful moment, because it's love. So there's always this, what he gives, he then takes away all the time. And I wanted to say something about Panama's bar that I read. And I think the Criterion people called it the depot for losers, which is, I mean, it's just a bar where you go when you have no place else to go. And Panama looks after you. So this is where Jean, this is where Jean found his refuge.
So the movie enters in a sort of second act at this point, where Jean is trying to see how he can find passage out of France. Nelly returns to the shop that she lives in with her guardian, and he's like, he's already known about the soldier, and he, you know, we find out some more about them. Meanwhile, back at Panama's, the artist has resolved with a plan to like end his own life, but leave his clothes and his passport and money for Jean to help him start a new life. So just a very intricate plot that we've got going on here. And by coincidence, Jean ends up walking into the shop that Zabel runs, and Zabel ends up trying to tempt Jean, because he susses out his desperate situation and tries to get him to like murder Lucien for him. In fact, I mean, just a very wonderfully constructed narrative.
Right.
There he got his new lease on life. So this has happened twice. Once he puts on the soldier's clothes and he becomes another man. Then when he can't live as that man anymore, he puts on the painter's clothes that he's inherited and becomes that man. So he's always taking on another man's identity.
Yeah, and we don't even really know the real him, except by implication of things he says and his reactions to other people. And
And you mentioned Sartre earlier, Doug, and that's exactly what Sartre was talking about, that the man is not no essence. You become what you do. So he keeps becoming these other people.
Throughout this movie, optimism and despair, or happiness and sadness, are clutched hand in hand. And you never know from one moment to another, really, although in some sense you do, which of the two will be triumphant. This bizarre contradiction seems to be woven throughout the narrative and throughout the visuals of the movie. As Lisa said, this should be the happiest moment of her life because she's fallen in love, but she leaps on a tram on a desolate street out of, you know, German, whatever the German cinema is called.
The street. Yeah. the German expressionistic street dramas or something.
Right.
So then the painter decides that he will give his identity to Jean. And so now Jean has a new identity and he's able to afford to get on a ship. And he meets up again with Nelly and they have a date that night and they really connect. Again, he confronts Lucien and slaps him around. And this time Lucien is really enraged because of the humiliation. And we can see that he's going to look for Jean with a gun at this point. But the key scene is Nelly and Jean in the hotel room. And Morgane's performance in this changes at this point. She relaxes and he relaxes. And I felt that it was one of the things that separates this from, like, I always compare to American films, and certainly American films at this time under the production code would not have a scene like this, that they'd be coy about it. But no, it's just right straight up that they're having sex. It's what adults do. And they find each other, and it makes their lives worthwhile at this point. But then events have come together. The body of the dead gangster has been found, and some clothes have been found of the soldiers. And he realizes that he has to leave, even though he was going to tell her that he was going to leave, and he maybe was going to stay, but now he has to leave. She knows he has to leave, and they're resolved to it, even though they've found each other. But they know they have to separate. And I think one of the most, like, more grown-up aspects of this film, which is something that you wouldn't find in a Hollywood film.
But remember, too, that morally, it is still quite conservative. I mean, at the end, we've already given away the ending. Jean kills Zabel, who is evil. Zabel is the evil character. He kills him, and we could think, okay, he even says to him, "You're so rotten, you don't deserve to live." But he has to die. I mean, in a film that, according to basically what became Hollywood code and is pretty much almost to this day, you know, a character who's going to commit something, a crime that is against God, against morality, cannot be rewarded.
Right.
Yeah. You know, so he kills someone, he has to die. There's no doubt that we know what's going to happen. And so this film might show people making love, but I think it maintains a kind of strict adherence to tradition.
Yeah, and they're punished for that, too.
Well, since we've given away the ending, how about just quickly, I really like how this movie...
You already gave it away, Matthew.
No, I want to talk about the little dog.
Oh, the doggy.
Fifth character. So Jean is taking the dog on board the ship that he's gotten passage on, and he just ties it up there. He's pacing around, and he has to go see Nelly. But then when he sees her... goes to the shop, he finds that Zabel's attacking her, and that leads to that.
Oh, yeah.
So it leads to him being shot at the end. Meanwhile, the dog is trapped in the ship, and the ship is about to leave, and the whistle is blowing, and the dog breaks out and runs down the gangplank. But then it doesn't run to the side of the man. It just runs back out into the country. And here, like in the beginning, we're in the empty road in the middle of the night. And here's the little dog back in its homeland, I guess, at the end.
The dog has abandoned these people.
Well, Doug pointed out earlier that the film ends where it begins. It's a traditional narrative. But I would say, remember what happens right before we see the dog. So Jean is shot dead in the street. Nelly is heartbroken. Yeah, there's a really intense romantic scene right there. I won't go into describing it. And then the last time we see Nelly, there's a close-up on her face, and she screams his name. And then there's a fade-out, and it goes immediately to the shot of the dog tied up in the ship. And so Jean, the dog, are very connected. Then the dog is straining against his tether. Finally, he bursts free. He runs out. And I think that there's a very definite possibility that we are being led to read this scene, that this dog has achieved the freedom that
he
has achieved. Right? That he's been released from his suffering and his bounds, what binds him to this life. And the dog has been released of his bounds, and he's... something else.
We're talking about Port of Shadows, 1938, by Marcel Carnet, starring Jean Gabin, Michel Simon, Michel Morgan, Pierre Brasseur, all names that would go to do great movies before that and after that.
Matthew, you've been asking about the influence of Port of Shadows on the French New Wave, and of course, Truffaut acknowledged Port of Shadows in his famous essay about that certain tendency in French cinema. But then you mentioned Godard's Breathless and its ending, and as you noted, it is a complete reversal of the end of Breathless. In Port of Shadows, Jean is gunned down by a gangster. In Breathless, by the police. In Port of Shadows, Nellie weeps over his corpse. In Breathless, she's the one who called the police in the first place and turned them in. And instead of weeping, she gets up and continues peddling the New York Herald Tribune. Godard once said that the best film criticism is to make another film. And this might be an early example of that principle in his practice. But equally important is the notion by Andrew Saris that all of cinema is at one, and each film needs to be revisited and reassessed from time to time so that the links between old films and new ones can be noted, so that with Breathless and Port of Shadows, both films can be registered in Saris's words, there are no waves, there is only an ocean. So thanks, Lisa, and thanks, Matthew. And thank you for listening to Community Radio, KBOO Portland. Film at 11.
You're tuned to listener-supported Community Radio, KBOO, Portland, Oregon, in the beautiful Willamette Valley.